The autopsy was performed on the Monday, the 27th. Then the coroner released the body on the Tuesday, the 28th. It was very strange spending Christmas Day with the family up there while Alice lay alone in the morgue.
I don't know, it was just like I hadn't seen her for a week or anything, like... Yeah, it didn't feel real.
Death takes everything eventually. It's the meanest, dumbest machine there is, and it just keeps coming and it doesn't care. There's nothing else to know about it, really.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dark Natter, the podcast where we look very, very closely to make sure we haven't missed anything. I am, as always, John Richter, and I am joined today by the highly mysterious Mr. James, who I will hand over to and allow you to introduce yourself.
G'day, John. How's it going?
Hang on a minute. The last time we spoke, you didn't have that accent, but I'm sure it will be relevant to what we're here to talk about.
Yeah, sorry, mate. I've been down at Lake Mungo. Just hanging out, just waiting for a mate. Yeah, so sorry about that, John. That was a poor attempt at an Australian accent.
Hello. Just assumed there was a different person that was in the room. I didn't realise it was you.
No, thank you very much for having me on Dark Natter, John. A real privilege, and even more excited to be talking about this, quite frankly, very underrated but brilliant film.
Oh, yeah, well, and thank you for recommending it. I'll quickly explain how we know each other, because it's kind of interesting, actually. But we're both in the sort of podcasting community, I suppose, for want of a better phrase. So I know you as the host of a podcast called Writing the Schoolies, which is a pun that works in the UK, but not in America, I think.
It really doesn't make any sense to the Yanks. they just think it's kind of adorable because it's British, but they don't really get that it's about people's genitals, really. Which, yeah. I suppose when you put it like that, it does make
maybe
it
that's the best. But it is, of course, yes. a podcast about people's memories of their time at school.
Yes. Not about their genitals, but it is about their memories of school. Whether those involve bollocks or not, who knows?
I mean, yeah, school probably involves a large amount of bollocks, doesn't it?
Yes.
And we're hopefully going to talk some today.
Well, we'll see.
But yeah, Writing the Schoolies, great podcast. You were very kind to have me on as a guest a little while ago, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And we talked about all manner of stuff, including, of course, your interest in dark fiction and horror movies and whatnot. And you recommended a film to me, and I was like, what's that? Never heard of Lake Mungo. What on earth is it? And then put it on my list, you know, must watch that film at some point, then promptly forgot about it. And then a few weeks later, I recorded an episode with a different bloke, a different guest called Matt Adcock, which at the time, let me get this right, this is all a bit back to the future. At the time of recording, that episode's been recorded but not aired, but who knows what order these things are going to come out in anyway.
Indeed.
And at the end of that episode, chatting away, and Matt says, I tell you what film you must watch, Lake Mungo. And I thought, ooh, that's two people who've given it a really big push now. This sounds like it's a bit of a must-see. So I watched it, and it is ace. So yes, can't wait to discuss that with you.
Excellent.
One thing I must mention, actually, very quickly, is just if anyone is listening to this show who has not seen Lake Mungo, then A, spoiler alert, we're going to ruin it. You might want to go and watch it first, because it is very spoilerable.
Good luck getting hold of a copy, though, which does sort of add to its allure, I think.
Correct. So it's not on any streaming service that's available in the UK at the time of recording, including even, you know, like obscure stuff like Shudder. Mm. And if you Google it, it's like, oh, yeah, available on Shudder. Not in the UK, it's not. So if you're a US listener, then you're lucky because you can. But I had to spend £40 on a DVD to get it. But it, like you say, I felt like I was watching, you know, like the video off The Ring or something.
Yeah, you're waiting for someone to crawl out of the TV.
Yeah, which thankfully didn't happen yet.
Out of interest, what was the price of the DVD affected by? Is it a Blu-ray? Has it got special treatment
just,
to it?
No, this was just
a made out of gold,
absolutely bog standard DVD. I think it's just that it's secondhand and people have realised it's hard to get hold of, so they can't put the price. But I think this month, at the time of recording, which is the month of May 2021. Ironic, there is a Blu-ray version coming out in the UK. So I think by the time you listen to this, if you want to get hold of it, you'll be able to get a Blu-ray for a vaguely sensible price instead of splurging 40 quid is the good news. well worth it, as you will soon find out.
Yes.
So, yes, what is Lake Mungo? Oh, well, actually, very quick pause and rewind. Given the video content sort of works. Why are we talking about Lake Mungo? Of course, it's because, as always on Dark Natter, my guest will pitch a dark fiction topic for me to consider for entry into our Hall of Fame, which we lovingly call the Hall of Pain. Give us your best Hall of Pain, Joe.
The Hall of Pine, mate.
Nice.
Oh, dear. I should say, full disclosure, I've actually lived in Australia, so I have no excuse for doing such a shit accent. But
I was very convinced. It's almost like you've got a sinister alter ego that keeps coming through.
my sinister alter ego called Bogan, who just happens to live under the bed. But my Australian accent sounds like a cross between Dame Edna Everidge and Chopper, which is
the two staples of Australian mainstream culture.
Absolutely right, yeah.
Chopper, the temptation to go off on a Chopper themed sideline, but we won't do that.
Do you tend to do a synopsis of something like the film? I only ask because I'm going through my head going, how on earth do you summarize this film? It's such a twisty turny sort of film.
Yeah, really. Definitely. I'll have a little stab at one. On my scribblings. If anyone's interested, before every show, I make some notes in an Excel spreadsheet. So it's got who directed it, what year it was, and what things I need to try and remember to say. So there you go, a peek behind the curtain to my sad accountant style mental workings. Lake Mungo is a 2008 psychological horror film, Australian, as you may have guessed from this introduction, written and directed by Joel Anderson, and starring a very talented cast, but I guess you'd say the sort of main star is a lady called Talia Zucker, who plays Alice Palmer. The sort of very brief synopsis of the plot is it's a fake documentary, so it's presented as if it's a real documentary about a real incident and so on, that incident being Alice Palmer's death. So a young lady called Alice Palmer tragically dies while her family are out. I think they're like out swimming or something. But it's not in Lake Mungo that they are swimming. It's in some other lake somewhere else. I think it's based in a place called Ararat.
That's right. Yeah. It's they also have everyone, if you don't know, slight geography lesson here. Lake Mungo is a real place, but it is in fact a dry lake. And while it does feature in the film much later on, as we'll get to, it isn't the lake in which Alice is initially discovered, or rather her body is initially discovered. That's an important distinction to make, I think.
Oh, very much so. And so it is one of those films where the title is a bit of a mini mystery. And this is one of those films where there's lots of mysteries, which is what makes it so good.
Yes.
So, you know, you could be forgiven for watching this. It's only about an hour and a half long. So like any good horror movie, it's kind of punchy and then done. But even you might be like an hour in and you're like, why is this called Lake Mungo? I don't understand why this film has that name, which in itself is quite compelling. But Alice Palmer drowns and dies and it's not a disappearance story. Her body is recovered. She is dead. And then the documentary, in effect, is charting how her parents and family and friends sort of react to this tragedy and some of the subsequent paranormal incidents that start to occur and envelop them all. But perhaps before we go any further into more of the detail, how did you first come across it, Joe?
Well, you know what? I had a little trip down memory lane, John, because we talked about how hard it is to get hold of this thing on DVD. So in 2008, when it would have been released, I was still in my second year of university and was probably too, drunk and distracted to have even thought about watching an obscure Australian horror film. Of course, you know, we think about late noughties, early sort of tens, if you like, was the age of massive video piracy, if you want, in terms of, you know, streaming stuff illegally, downloading stuff illegally, because DVDs started to become, maybe not phased out, but streaming services weren't quite what they are now.
And everyone, they haven't found a way to sort of police it, have they? So it's almost like now you've got Netflix and Spotify is how they've monetized it, but go back 10 years and it was all bloody Kazaa and LimeWire and just get everything. Why would you pay for anything ever when you could just nick it off the internet?
Well, precisely. And that did... That did add to how I first came across Litmonger. So fast forward a couple of years from the release date, and it is 2011, I believe. Yours truly is living in South Korea. I'm doing my first teaching post out there. And obviously, you spend quite a lot of time away from work, you know, and sort of sat in your one-room apartment. And, you know, it's probably around then I started really binging on stuff, you know, in terms of... series and films. And again, you know, the fastest internet probably in the West, in the developed world is in South Korea or Japan. So downloading stuff from, you know, whatever dodgy source I could find was pretty good. And I managed to get hold of like a list of, you know, really, you know, really great found footage horror was the list I remember, because I started to go through a phase of, you know, rewatching things like Blair Witch and all this. Anyway, got hold of Late Mungo on that list, and I was gonna leave it, but then I saw it was Australian, and a bit of me went, okay, because there's a really good Australian horror film that I'd seen recently called The Tunnel, which I would also recommend. It's a bit more in the classic found footage. There's a scary thing, and it's chasing them while the camera is shaking around. You know, it's good, it's fun. But Late Mungo, I downloaded it and sat there on my own in my apartment. As it was getting dark on a sort of Sunday evening, I remember sitting there and watching it and thinking, you know, this could be just a nice... It's more of like a murder mystery. I quite like those. Okay, no problem. Okay. And then as the evening wore on, and like you said, it's not the longest of films, but I started to experience a creeping dread I don't think I've experienced very often when watching a film. The last time it happened to me recently was when I watched Hereditary. I had a similar... visceral feeling of dread and genuine horror.
Brilliant.
As things unfolded. Now, of course, the fact that I downloaded it made this even more mysterious, because it was, for a minute or two, I was like, have I accidentally downloaded something that is like genuine? Like, this is a genuine documentary. Like, maybe I've got it wrong. Maybe that list has got it wrong. And so I had to stop the film and go and just check. This is a film, right? Because this is really fucking me up.
And you get, like, when the Blair Witch Project first came out, which of course is the sort of, generally regarded as the sort of birth of the found footage kind of genre. And that's, there's a blurring of the lines there, isn't there, between fake documentary and found footage. And often, you know, the Blair Witch Project ostensibly is some documentary filmmakers whose footage was recovered.
They just never managed to make the documentary because they were too busy getting chased by Rustin Parr.
Exactly, too busy disappearing and dying, or maybe, or not.
Or not, yes.
It's, you know, lovely ambiguous ending, as these films often have.
The other thing I was just going to say really quick was that when the film ended, and we're going to talk about the ending, so I don't want to sort of go over that yet, because I think that
absolutely it merits a nice build up, because it's a belter.
It really does. But the so by the time the film's finished, it's easily about sort of 10-11 o'clock at night, and I'm lying there, and I don't really suffer with sleep problems very often. I never really have. I'm quite a renowned champion sleeper. I didn't sleep a bloody wink really that night. I lay there just picturing quite a lot of what had happened, and a lot of stuff that I hadn't seen. And this is, I think, this is the beauty of this film, is that it creeps under your skin and it stays there for a very long time without necessarily having all that many big standout moments. It's an ensemble piece, and it really, really got to me. And then I remember a few weeks down the line, you know, obviously I then had it still stored, and myself and my... my then girlfriend, we watched it together. And of course, watching it for the second time, knowing what's going to happen, I think I experienced that same creeping dread more, but from the very off.
Yeah,
because I knew how it was going to go, and I found it unbearable. It was so good,
Yeah, like you're almost kind of the ending. You know the ending. It's not got the surprise factor, but it's so horrifying that you almost repeats the fear the second time.
And I was waiting for it to happen, and in a way that made the whole thing worse. And it's then been a mainstay. And unfortunately, I'm now thinking about the last time I saw it would have probably been about 2 years ago when it was available briefly on Amazon Prime, alas, no longer. And I decided to, again, you know, sucker for punishment, watch it just to see how it held up. And on a much larger TV these days, bits of it still look fantastic. Other bits of it, which we'll talk about later on, I found myself going, that doesn't work quite as well, because part of the shtick is the era that it's set in and the footage being what it is. But it still worked on every other level for me. It still holds up.
Yeah, it's interesting that actually that sort of the technology that you use to consume your scary movies on can make a big difference to the experience. Like I had a very quick tangential. I went to watch Akira Yamaoka, the bloke who did the soundtrack to the Silent Hill games. He did some live shows a few years ago.
Oh, wow.
And it was a brilliant setup. They had this it was some place called The Laundry in, I can't even remember which bit of London it's in, somewhere in London. And it was like an underground venue. It was quite big and loads of people there. I was like, oh, this is going to be a bit obscure. It was rammed, hundreds of people. They had a pyramid head, you know, a big muscly bloke walking around with his fake pyramid head on, a big sword. Loads of creepy nurses. And they had like a side room with an old-fashioned chunky telly, not a flat screen, with Silent Hill 2 on it on a PS2.
Oh,
so you
can
just pick up the controller and just have a crack. But because the telly was old and the picture was therefore a bit crackly and a bit ropey, it just, I had a quick go on it, obviously, while we were waiting for him to come on. And it was like, oh, this is a loads better way to play this game than on a modern TV. So yeah, there's something to be said for watching old crackly found footage horror on an old crackly telly.
Well, and especially when you think, it's a bit like with, obviously something like Ghostwatch, which is a fantastic sort of fake documentary. While we're on that, it's easily one of my favourites. I watch it once a year, every year, and I was lucky enough to speak to Stephen Volk about it, which I'm sure he gets really bored of. He's like, I have written other things, but you're just like, no, talk to me about Ghostwatch.
Yeah, you're the Ghostwatch guy. Oh, just really quick interjection. Ghostwatch is my favourite horror, I'm going to say movie, it's not actually a movie because it was a made-for-TV thing on BBC, and we already did an episode on it because of how much I love Ghostwatch.
I think it was the first of your episodes I ever listened to, actually.
Ah, fantastic. We've been brought together by Ghostwatch, and I'm well jealous that you've spoken to Stephen Volk, who, of course, is the writer and creator of that amazing piece of telly. But brilliant.
It's more that when you listen to the sort of a documentary about a fake documentary behind the curtains, they talk about the way in which certain, the technology these days to be able to stop, stream, go back, go forward, whatever, it changes the relationship that you have with it. And that's why, bits like is that a figure of a person standing by the curtain in the dark, and it's that thing of showing you things and not showing you again. And I think that's really brave, and it's harder to do now because I think our eyes are more attuned to crisper, higher def images. If I ever turn on the TV and it's in standard def because we've got a 50 something inch screen downstairs, I find it really distracting, the fact that it's not great quality. Your eyes do get spoilt by it, I think. And I guess, going back to a time when everything's a little bit grainy, everything's a little bit blurry, a bit pixelated. And this definitely leads into some of the amateur footage in this film,
Late
Mungo. It adds a layer of creepiness and ambiguity that just doesn't work as well now, I don't think.
Yeah, totally. It's a little kind of lost bygone age of technology. Emerging technology, video and film and mobile phones, but when they were all still a bit crap. And
I think they call it Web 1.0, I think is the sort of term, when you'd scroll down and it would be in sort of word art and,
Modem.
Nothing would be, Yeah, nothing would be
sound effects
properly.
And like everyone had a MySpace page and all that stuff. Yeah. But it was kind of charming in a way, you know what I mean?
But yeah, some charming but very pixelated pornography could be found, I'm sure, at that point in time with the dial-up internet.
Yeah, that would have taken, you know, 3 hours to download a 10-second clip that turned out to just be someone going, "Heh, heh, not really."
Or someone just ringing the door and say, "Hello, I'm here to fix your washing machine," and then it stops. You go, "Oh bloody hell!"
Oh well, that'll have to do. So like Mungo then.
Yes.
So one other thing worth mentioning before I forget is, of course, astute listeners will have clocked that the name of the deceased sort of main character is Alice Palmer, which mm-hmm. is definitely an intentional Twin Peaks reference. So there's a whole piece yes. here about, as the documentary filmmakers delve into Alice's past and the mystery, they find out things about her that maybe were not known to her parents, and she mm-hmm. maybe wasn't quite as sweet and innocent as they thought, and so on and so on. Definite deliberate parallels with Twin Peaks and the mm-hmm. investigation of the death of Laura Palmer, but it doesn't feel like an over-the-top, "Oh, this is just ripping off a load of Twin Peaks' ideas" at all. It feels very distinct and different. It's more of just a little homage because of that core nugget of it's an investigation of the mystery of a dead girl.
I mean, I felt it was definitely more of an homage. And to be honest, I actually missed that the first time around. I don't know why. I was so taken in by the verisimilitude of the filmmaking that I sort of didn't stop to really analyse the moving parts. It was only later when somebody said, "Oh yeah, you know, so dead girl found in a lake, Palmer." Oh, bit of a Twin Peaks reference. Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. You know, but it is good. But similarly to Twin Peaks, I think it has that same. It focuses more on a family rather than a place, which of course is the same thing in some way. But again, Twin Peaks for me, especially early Twin Peaks, and dare I say the pun, peak Twin Peaks, is really scary.
Totally,
it's really
agree.
Unsettling and just gets under your skin again. So yeah, I think there are worse things to try and imitate, I would say.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think people sort of, partly because it went a bit off the rails in the middle of its run, Twin Peaks, where it got cancelled, and it went a bit daft soap, bordering on kind of a comedy in a way.
Yeah.
And it always had funny elements, but yeah, in effect, Twin Peaks was a pretty good horror show for a good chunk of its run. Maybe people kind of forget that a little bit, but this film is definitely nothing but horror. Well, I say that, what it does benefit from, one of the reasons the horror is so effective is because of how realistic the fake documentary is. And it's it's brilliantly made by the bloke whose name I've forgotten, Joel Anderson. Absolutely brilliant. But also, the entire cast is completely convincing and realistic. So you sort of don't... you don't start to doubt, you know, "Oh, there's a bit of a ropey acting performance there that's taken me out of the moment." And, you know, these micro-budget films can sometimes suffer from just crap actors, basically. And it's just a fantastic performance by the entire cast.
What I liked about that, and this sort of, I guess, helps us move along into, like, the opening scenes, really, is that it very much is a talking heads production for large parts of it. You have these sort of vox pops from members of Alice's immediate sort of circle, obviously her family, friends at high school, and then of course as things develop and we learn more about what was really going on in her past, we actually hear very little from Alice, I believe, and do correct me if I'm wrong because it's been a while since I've seen it. The only time we really hear her voice properly is at the very beginning when we hear her on a tape speaking about she's feeling scared that something's going to happen to her. But yet we don't often see her talk,
which
I think is really, really good and a very unsettling device as well.
Yeah, it makes her seem, she come almost like a bit of a ghostly character that, wasn't she so lovely? Everyone loved her. Aren't we so, you know, bereaved now that she's gone? And you don't get that much of her being her real self, which is obviously, you know, a teenager who's growing up and having lots of teenager type experiences and some slightly more sinister ones, as we'll get to.
Yes.
And so it means that it is more powerful when you do see these reveals. It's a little bit more jarring because you've had this kind of angelic figure that's then, "Oh God, right, okay." So then, you know, was not necessarily having the best time after all behind the scenes. But maybe we should get into a little bit of the plot.
Yeah.
So family are out swimming about in Lake Ararat or whatever it's called, and then there's a the whole documentary opens with this pretty horrifying 911 or whatever. What's the Australian version of 911?
You know what? I think it might actually be. No, it can't be 119.
You're doing the upside down version. Oh, I suppose for the UK's is 999, so the Aussie one would be 666, wouldn't it?
It's actually 000. I've just checked.
In
the time that I was in Australia, thankfully, I never actually had to phone that number. But yeah, it's 000.
There is a call to the emergency services placed by Alice's mum, who is distraught because their daughter has disappeared while swimming. So that the concern is that she's got into difficulties and they can't find her and they're shouting her name and blah, blah, blah. Quickly, we learn that she has drowned. She has got into difficulties. She drowned. There's a salvage, you know, an operation to dredge the river or lake or whatever it is. And they find her body and she is dead. Yeah. Very sad. And you get a lot of these kind of poignant, you know, there's like a shot of the family together. It's like a mum, dad, teenage daughter who is sadly died, and then a slightly younger young teen brother. That's the kind of core family unit. Am I forgetting anyone? No, I think they are just the four of them.
That seems to be the nuclear family, typical sort of two kids. I can't really recall if her brother's supposed to be very, very close to her in age, or if he's ever so slightly older or younger. I think it's never really revealed, but he's definitely, like you say, he's a teenager himself. Alice is supposed to be around 16, I think, so age.
And it spends it dwells for quite a long time in that kind of like the sadness and the grief of the parents and those others in the community who've been affected by Alice's death. And we meet her, she had a boyfriend, you know, another teenage young lad. And there's like a quite poignant bit where he says, even though he'd been told that she died, his first reaction was to phone her mobile because he just didn't believe it and wanted to, you know, phone her up and check that it was true. And then
some interesting foreshadowing there as well with the mobile.
Absolutely. Well, I did a bad Aussie impression myself there, didn't I? Really? That was very regrettable. So we spend a bit of time with the family and learning about this grief. And it takes a little while before we get the first paranormal murmurings. And the idea is that they start to experience some slightly weird goings on in their house, sort of centered around Alice's bedroom. So it's like, doors opening and closing and things moving around. And it's all just very kind of anecdotal. But it's enough for them to want to start to take investigative steps. And I think they initially they sort of rig up a camera just to sort of see.
The way I remember it, and I could be slightly misremembering it here, but is that the brother has an interest in photography, and he's very much got the, you know, the typical taking pictures of, you know, sunsets and a drop of water on a table. I don't know, that sort of stuff. But it's for a school project, I think, or something. And he begins then taking pictures around the house. And I can't remember if it happens before he sets up the video or not, but he takes a picture and Alice is in the picture, sort of just out of shot. Now, this is our first sort of, I guess our first, not our first horror moment, I think, because we do see a very quick shot of her dead body when they've found it. And it's like a very medical picture, isn't it? And it shows like the sort of the algae and the sort of, you know, the fact one of her eyes is sort of very much closed. It's a shocking picture, but it's only seen briefly. So we know she's dead. Like, we've actually seen it. It isn't like a mystery. Oh, is she or isn't she dead? It's like, no, she's actually dead, but we're seeing these pictures.
Yeah, you're spot on it. You know, the film definitely doesn't rely on any sort of cheesy jump scares or any sort of gore, but it does, and I think it's necessary to give you that shot of her dead body. Maybe they wouldn't in a real documentary, so maybe it's one of the elements where it has to push the boundary a little bit.
I did find that. I don't think they would have done that. That wouldn't be out for general release if they did that.
It's needed to drive home that she's dead. This once beautiful, young, promising young woman is now this corpse on this table with a melty eye and a, you know, waterlogged, grotesque kind of image. It's pretty harrowing. But that arguably, I suppose, is a horror image. but still within the story, it's completely kind of realistic. Whereas this photograph and her just standing there, like looking like a normal self, just in the background of the garden, is your first horror, creepy sort of paranormal thing. And it, and I got, you know, goosebumps, chills just from that photo. Brilliant.
And they also do that Blade Runner thing of like finding the bit of the photo and then zooming in on it, which I don't know why. I've always had this sort of recurring nightmare, and I had it before I saw Leitmonger, so maybe this is why it tripped so many buttons for me, was that I've always had this nightmare, recurring nightmare ever since I was a little kid, about seeing something scary in a picture and then it almost like zooming in on it so I can't look away. And it's that it's that same, I think, maybe forcing you to look at something. There's probably some deep subconscious reason, but you know, anyway, I think when we see that first time, like you say, she is just there. She doesn't look like there's no sort of obvious, and we know why later on, there's no obvious like degradation of her face. She's just like almost looks as she did in life.
Yeah, it's not a ghost. Well, it very quite possibly is a ghost, but it's not presented in a horror-y, you know, it's not the Grudge with a broken neck.
She doesn't have her hair over her face or anything like that.
Yeah.
She looks just as she always did. And then I believe it's when the brother begins setting up the camera.
Yes.
Pointing it largely in the direction of her room, and like, because there's a corridor, isn't there, between the two? And I think that's when they see the first movement of something.
Yeah, there's like a blur, very blurry, hard to tell what it is, but someone clearly sort of emerges from, I think it's from her room, and kind of walks across the corridor. Mm. And so you, at this point, you're like, oh my God, like this is, it seems like there's a body of evidence that there is a haunt. She is, the ghost of Alice is haunting the house. And I quite liked how the parents, they don't overdo anything and they avoid cliches. Right. So instead of, oh, the mum believes and the dad thinks it's bollocks and then they get divorced, you know, that would have been kind of the obvious story to do, but they don't do that. They do, or, you know, gender roles could have been switched, but still, you know, one parent believes and one parent doesn't believe would have been the obvious way to, and they don't, they just sort of do a, well, you know, this happened, and so as a result, we thought we might need to explore it further. And so you get, there's they contact this kind of psychic bloke.
Yeah.
Who's, I think, is his character called Ray Kemeny, I think.
Ray Kemeny, what a name.
And he's just a bit like, I don't know, slight cheesy, odd sort of TV psychiatrist kind of paranormal guy.
Little bit of a Twin Peaks reference there as well, really, when you think about these, you know, when they find out later on that she'd been seeing him, I think, not in like a romantic sense, but like she'd already been having conversations with him. And then, of course, when he's called in by the family, he's in a bit of a tryst because he can't tell them that he was already seeing her because of the patient
confidentiality. Well, but so that is where the pacing of this film, I think, is really good, is that it does sprinkle in these kind of, not exactly red herrings, but certainly suspects and twists and reveals that, you know, keep the mystery going. And this is one of the first ones that, after spending a bit of time with Ray, and he at one point encourages him to undertake a seance. The family, you know, the dad's not really up for it, but he goes along with it, and nothing happens. But they film the seance, and then again in the footage, we
see Alice's face reflected in a mirror. Is that correct?
You may well be completely right. She's definitely lurking in the background.
Yes.
But, at the very end of the hallway. But I can't remember if she's meant to be standing there or a reflection. But either way, it's a real kind of powerful, oh my God, she was there watching the seance. And you think the film is very much taking you down this paranormal route at this point, only for there to be this series of kind of swerves, one of which is she herself had started going to this psychic. And we get some footage of one of her visits, and this is because she believed she was being sort of haunted or pursued by kind of dark forces, and something bad was kind of imminent. But the fact that he doesn't tell him makes him seem a bit dodgy and almost seems to implicate him for a while.
Well, there's a bit of that, and then I think the other part of this sort of early haunting aspects that I thought was really well played, like you say, they don't overdo it. The pacing is masterful because they allow us to keep seeing not quite anything, and yet just enough for it to be something. And then that's backed up with a few anecdotes. And I think brilliantly played from the dad as well. Because because the dad has obviously seen her body. I think that's the sort of mini subplot within this, is that the dad saw the body. He actually had to identify her. But the mum chose not to. The mum chose to completely not do that. And understandable, of course. And I've always wondered, in my more morbid moments, would I want to be the one that actually does that? And the answer is often no. Yeah. And yet, for some people, they say, well, and, you know, I want the closure.
Yeah.
So because the dad had seen her body, he had maybe started on the next process of grief, the healing process of accepting that she was gone. The mum, I don't think, had still accepted that she's gone, and actually really starts to believe that maybe she's still out there, because there's this... There's this worry from the mum's side. Well, what if she's not actually, you know, what if she's not actually dead? What if it was a mistake? What if he misidentified the body? There's all these what ifs. It's the hope, isn't it? And I think they do a DNA test, and it's like, no, she.
Yeah, she, I think, is they go as far to it as to exhume the corpse to double check. And the dad, as you said, he's seen the dead body, he's identified it, but even he says himself, he starts to doubt it, and it's like, maybe I got it wrong. Mm. I mean, this footage is pretty compelling. And then I think there's another video that emerges from some hikers in the area.
That's right, yes.
And there's the girl in the distance in the background of the footage, again, just staring.
The hikers, one of them, I believe, is one of my favourite and most Australian-sounding blokes, Bob Smate.
Bob the Smate footage.
There are these sort of other sightings. And then I think... Because for me, I was getting to a point where I was going, where are they going to go with this? Like, I was enjoying the ride. I was thinking, okay, well, typically there's going to be a rising point of action here to one of them is going to actually, or we're going to see Alice, like, you know, in the house at some point. And I think the closest we get to it initially is that the dad says that he had an experience where he saw her.
Yes.
In her room. And she turned around and, like, screamed at him to get out.
Yeah.
But it's sort of led as, like, whether or not he's almost doubting whether or not it really happened, or if it's all in his head. And again, this film captures that mind fog that you must have when you're undergoing extreme grief.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
That, you know, you lose sense of reality. And of course, the dad's so stoic, isn't he? He's this real, you know, stiff upper lip boy sort of man. And so to have him say, well, she was screaming at me to get out of the room, you know, and of course that then...
Oh, you feel really sorry. You feel really sorry for him, don't you? And then,
really,
and then you get, this is where we get some more sort of reveals. Really, again, I'll probably misremember the order, but all very sort of cleverly interspersed. Really, and keeps the momentum building. You get the reveal that the brother, whose name I think is Matthew, Matthew. He, in his manifestation of teenage grief. You know, slightly weird, but this is what happens, I guess. He's been faking the video footage. So he's bloody superimposed the Alice's image into the photo, and he's put the face in the video. And it's all because I think he almost wants, he's not entirely seeking attention for himself.
No.
I think he wants attention to be focused on Alice, because he doesn't want the memory of his beloved sister to just disappear. So very sad, very sad.
And one of them is quite a clever trick, really, in that the image of Alice lurking in the background at the seance is actually old video footage that he puts on their TV and then angles the camera so that we can see the camera, sorry, not the camera, so that we can see the mirror with Alice's face, because obviously it's not just a stock still image, she's sort of smiling and she's... Because clearly it's a piece of footage that's been slowed right down. It's very atmospheric, of course.
And makes you, and obviously then you start to question, oh, is the brother something to do with her death? Because this is weird behaviour, right? So that gives you another little mini suspect. And then we get, this is where it gets very clever, is the reveals within reveals. So we've had the footage, then we've had the boom, there's Alice in the background. Now we've had the, but actually it's bollocks because Matthew just faked it. But then we get the... There's another thing in the background of the same footage. And the first one of these we get is a face that... So while we've got the camera angled down the corridor and the figure that walks past, which turns out to be Matthew dressed up as Alice, and also in the Bob Smate footage, that was Matthew with a wig on or whatever. You know, it's all been him. But in the corridor footage, I think on the side, you can see into her room through the window. And yeah, there's a bloke in the room. There's some fella in there, which is like, whoa, kind of shocker.
Before we go any further, the first time I watched this, again, I was watching it on a more sort of standard def, smaller television, all of this. And it really took me by surprise, as it's supposed to, I believe. And obviously, when I watched it not all that long ago on my much larger TV, due to the aspect ratio, you can see the neighbour... Sorry, it's the neighbour, spoiler alert, who's actually in the... Yes. Who's in her room. You can actually see the neighbour right away, like in the very first time they show the footage of Alice supposedly walking past, which is a bit of a bugger. I guess in a way, it's that idea of, like, in most magic tricks, there's a sleight of hand. They want you to look this way so they can do something over here.
Yes.
And it plays very much like that. You're paying attention to the movement of something ghostly, of course, but actually it's a lovely sleight of hand that the thing that you really should have been watching was... The neighbour, I forget his first name, but one of the they're called the Tuies, I believe.
Oh, well remembered. I'll have to have a look. But yeah, you're spot on. Yeah, Brett Tuie is his name.
Brett Tuie.
He's a well, just very quickly, I agree with you completely about the kind of sleight of hand thing. I suppose it's in a way it's a bit like a good thriller where the clues were there all along. So you sort of, in a way, I don't mind that it is possible that a viewer might spot him the first time they see the footage, because I sort of think, well, you're being rewarded for being eagle-eyed. And I'd much prefer that to, if you watch the film back and you found out that he wasn't there the first time and they grafted him in later to make sure they didn't spoil it, that would seem like cheating to me. So I think it's maybe okay. But Brett Tuie and his wife are a pair of kind of perverts, really, aren't they?
Well, this isn't... It's a strange one, mate. Maybe because I was much younger when I first watched it, this aspect of it was a bit like, ugh, but it didn't really... I didn't find myself, like, being that disturbed by it. And yet, of course, maybe it's just because I'm getting older, and I think about things in very different, certainly more human terms, maybe, than when I was a younger man and was just like, oh, where's the scary stuff? What's going on here? I found this on repeat watching deeply uncomfortable and made me, it adds to that, like I said, that creeping sense of dread. Because really they are, or at least Brett is, I don't know. I mean, is it fair to label him a paedophile? Because technically she's supposed to be 16, which I believe is the age of consent in Australia, like it is over here, but it's still fucking weird.
He's like, what is he, the late 30s or something?
Yeah.
And it's not that he's having an affair with her behind his back. She's sleeping with them both at the same, in like a threesome kind of way.
And you may wonder, if you've not seen the film, how would we know this? Well, of course, the reason why Brett Tuie is in Alice's room is because he's trying to recover, without success, a sex tape that him and his wife have made, which we are, and this is pretty shocking. We actually get to see
a short clip of
this, and it's that horrible thing of, you know, Alice has not been she's not we haven't really heard much of her voice. We hear about her, but we don't necessarily hear about her. I think that's quite symbolic. There's an element of a bit like with an Inspector Calls by J.B. Priestley. You've got this Eva Smith style character who is like she's been abused basically by other people in her life, which is why she's ended up where she is. And of course, with the Tuies, you see another clip later on of, like, they've got all the neighborhood kids around at their pool for a party, and you get the impression that because she used to babysit for them, you know, and this sounds weird given the context of what we're talking about, but, you know, she is the actress who plays Alice is a very, very pretty.
She's very, very pretty
and very sort of, but there's a pain and a sadness behind her eyes. And when you realise that she's clearly been groomed, and maybe they are, I don't know, you know, people's sex lives are what they are, but they've decided to try and involve her.
And the recording of it as well.
And the recording of it,
just a bit kind of,
it's horrid,
unsavory. And it doesn't go too much into the Tuies and what they may or may not have done, as you say, with other potential people, whether consensual adults or child victims. You know, not sure, but yeah, it's definitely, you know, they've recorded this video, given her, she's acquired a copy of it and she's got it hidden in a safe that is hidden in a room that her parents are unaware of, that this safe was even there.
Of course.
And I guess that's, you know, takes us on to another reveal, propels us forward with this exciting narrative to the next reveal, which is there's not just this tape, but there's also she's got a diary, you know, in
yes.
typical, slightly cliched teenage girl dead body style. There's always a diary and she does have one. But I can't remember what is the main sort of thing they ascertain from the diary, other than I think this might be the first time we start to get mentions of Lake Mungo for the first
yes.
time.
Yes. That was my understanding of it, is that in her diary, she was talking about how she was having these disturbing dreams, I think, about Lake Mungo. And of course,
is this after she's been there on a school trip?
I think it may be. And this is the thing with the continuity of the film, is obviously we're hearing about stuff in retrospect, obviously, because Alice is dead. But that sense that we're hearing about stuff, you know, we don't know if this thing with the Tuohys led her to be in this situation, or if it was just a symptom of her general sort of malaise that was going on. Because I think sorry to go back to the Tuohys really quickly. I think continuity is that because the parents only found out about it now, but then of course the Tuohys skipped town, didn't they? They left.
Yes. And there's almost like a hunt that is commenced for them, or for certainly for Brett Tuohy, because now again he becomes a conceivable. There is this idea that, well, maybe she didn't drown by accident, maybe she was killed, or maybe he was somehow implicated, or so. Yeah, he's done a runner, hasn't he? The two of them have escaped.
And it's that idea again to sort of mention like an Eva Smith style character. It might, you know, I mean, Brett Tuohy, we know, didn't kill Alice, you know, he didn't, what was his motive, but he certainly had every motive to want to try and cover up what he'd done, which is why he was searching her room hoping to find the tape. And I think it's quite an interesting insight into Alice's character that she was able to get hold of the tape and pilfer it and keep it almost as collateral, almost as like a, you know what, maybe she did know that something bad was going to happen to her. Certainly she sounds like she's had this sense of foreboding. And there is a catharsis, as horrible as it is, there is a catharsis to know that they didn't get away with it. You know, it wouldn't be lost to time as such.
Yeah, it's like, no, it's under there. The carpet, it was the reveal. And I suppose in a way at this point of the movie, before we get into Lake Mungo and why it's called Lake Mungo, you could have a, you know, full stop. She was a abused, sad, unhappy teenager. She had this weird relationship going on the side as well as a boyfriend.
Yeah.
And she had some perhaps psychological problems. She was seeing this psychic bloke and doing these, you know, hypnosis sessions, very troubled. Maybe she committed suicide. Maybe she drowned herself on purpose, and that's the implication.
Yes, and this is, of course, what we then pick up. So again, I remember watching it for the first time, and my brain's doing backflips, going, I don't know how to access. I don't know where this is going, and I don't quite know. I don't know. It felt very real, in that most real mysteries, there is no neat and obvious answer. And in fact, I think that this film does one thing very well. It's content to leave you with not a huge amount in the way of answers.
Totally. But equally, I think that, like, I've seen this film described as like sad. It's the saddest horror film you'll ever see. And it definitely, at this point, you just think, oh, what a shit, you know, piece all this together. This, you know, you've got the sad brother who's faking the paranormal things. You've got the sad psychic who's, whether he's milking the family for money, that's not entirely clear. You've got the sad girl who's died and she'd had some bad experiences. It all just does feel, it is a sense of kind of sadness rather than entirely horror at this point.
And as well, you know, you think, you know, maybe it affected me a little bit more I thought about it, because, you know, I've got a younger sister who, weirdly enough, actually, you know, is kind of quite very, very pale of face and quite sort of dark of hair, like Alice.
It's a bit like I've got like blonde twin sisters. So whenever there's whenever there's either twins or young blonde women in films, like, there's, you always have this sense of, oh, that's like my sister, so you have an affinity for them, kind of thing.
But it's also the fact that, you know, my sister's a fairly secretive soul. And this film did sort of make you think, geez, you know, the idea that somebody could be suffering so much and their parents wouldn't know. And just to sort of go back slightly with the parents, one thing that I remember was that the mum admits in these vox pops to camera that she never really had a bond with her own mother, not a proper one. And so she never really was able to form a proper bond with Alice. And that's, it's another layer of sad when you think about it. This is as much a film about the breakdown of the family unit and its vulnerability to corruption from nefarious,
seemingly happy outside perception family unit, but inside there were problems. So you could end the story there. But I do think the final kind of swerve is a masterstroke.
Really is.
Because we learn that Alice is, through the diary and through interviews with some of her friends, that her sort of, let's call them psychological problems or troubled behaviours and so on, seem to start following a school outing where they all went out to... Finally, drumroll, Lake Mungo, which, as you explained, is not a lake with water in it. It's the what used to be a lake with dry soil in it, kind of arid.
And something to bear in mind, it's for those of you that are interested in ever visiting, it is the place where they found the oldest human remains found in Australia. Somebody called Mungo Man and Mungo Woman. And they were found, oldest human remains in the world to be ritually cremated. And they found that the remains were over 40,000 years old.
Oh my God! Right. Interesting.
So there is something I think very symbolic in that. Of course,
you've got your sort of ancient burial ground kind of energy going on there. In that case,
absolutely. Yeah, and I'm not really sure how to approach the big final reveal. So let me just tell you my experience of it and the first time I watched it, because this was still how I feel about it now. So. We get quite an extended sequence of mobile phone footage. And this extended bit of mobile phone footage, at first, which reminded me of every sixth form party I ever went to. Someone's lit a bloody fire, everyone's drinking, you know, and of course back then, you know, you had a phone that was a bit like a potato when it came to actually videoing stuff. You can see like the broad idea of there being fire there, and you can see like faces but not actually make out features. And it's sort of panning around, and we do see Alice sort of almost staring into the flames, and her face is very impassive, very hard to read.
Yeah.
You know, and so this is from someone else's footage quite clearly. And then we switch footage to someone else clearly at the party, and what we see in the distance is Alice burying something. Now, again, the symbolism there, pretty obvious, but... She's been caught burying something out near Lake Mungo, and
her parents have said in the prelude to this that when they're sort of we remember she went on a trip to Lake Mungo, I do remember she turned up and she managed to lose her phone and lose her wallet and lose all her stuff. God, teenagers, kind of that's what their recollection is.
And of course, the idea of a teenager losing a phone and not really making a big fuss about it should have raised alarm bells immediately, I think. But this phone is then discovered, and I think this is what we're then discovering almost in real time with the parents, in a way, is that they find the phone and they then find the footage. And this is, I remember getting this drop in my stomach when that comes across the bottom of the screen, saying Alice's mobile phone footage recovered from Lake Mungo, and I just thought,
because you know that this all right, this is the sort of reveal, this is the finale. There's something's going to come of this now. This is going to be of significance.
Oh, and I'm not joking. I don't like to use hyperbole. I mean, I'm getting goose flesh actually just trying to think about it.
Agreed.
So
it's very funny. Very funny.
So the mobile phone footage is as grainy as you would expect from a phone in around 2005, which is when it's supposed to be set.
I'm going with it. I reckon it was one of them like Motorola, Samsung flip phones that look like a washing machine.
Possibly one of those, maybe one of the old Nokia ones with the camera in the front. But either way, you know, no flash. Maybe it's, there is a slight flash. So yeah, like the very very limited flash that would stay on when you were filming. So as you can imagine, it's dark as all shit out here, you know, and there's nothing to see, which begs the question, why is she filming? And as she's walking forward...
She's wandered off from the group, hasn't she? Yeah. So she is alone at this point in the wilderness, which is a bit silly and a daft idea, but for whatever reason, she's felt compelled to go exploring off from the group.
And you can't see anything, really, at all. At least for a couple of seconds, you can't see a thing. And you can hear that sort of wind sort of sound effect. Yeah. And the until you see someone or a humanoid figure just like directly at 12 o'clock, you know, coming towards her. And it's walking just as she's walking. And it gets closer and closer, and of course, you can't make out anything other than it's a shape of a person. You start to question, well, hang on, who is this person? As it gets a little bit closer, you begin to see that it has long hair, and I do remember my heart just started hammering away in my chest, and I was shrinking away from the TV, going, oh fucking hell, and as this figure just gets close enough to be made out by the light of the phone, we get a pause, don't we? Everything pauses, and it is Alice's bloated corpse, basically.
It's walking
towards her.
Which is why the film kind of had to show us it earlier.
Yes.
For this to work.
Which but makes sense now.
Yeah, and it's a very recognisable, because they did that thing with the, you know, melty eye, I suppose you call it, or one of, you know, droopy, waterlogged, rotten face. Yeah. And you're like, it clearly is, she has been face to face with her own future dead body out in the wilderness. And it's like, what the, oh my God, how would you even, so yeah. So, unsurprisingly, she reacts badly to this. Decides to bury everything and bin the phone off. And
it's probably the only thing that gets close to being a jump scare is that they pause the video while we see it, and then there's a voiceover saying, "I forget exactly what said, but it's, you know, something explanatory about, you know, this is clearly what Alice had seen." And da 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 da, and then suddenly the video plays again, and like this face rushes forward at the screen. It's not a, you know, it isn't the old. I hate the when they've done something to make the eyes black, and they've done like a big mouth. It's nothing like that.
And they put some non-diegetic sound effect over the top. That's my most hated feature of the jump scare. I'm in the cinema. You've just made me jump. But the reason I jumped is because you played a massive piano, noise at the time. It's like you've cheated.
And they could well have done that there, and probably would have been forgivable. But it didn't need it. And actually, what I loved about that was that it's then left as ambiguous. Like, did she? What happened to the body is what I want to know. Like, did the body carry on walking the other way? Did the body try and embrace her? It reminded me of some of those old M.R. James stories of, like, you know, something clambering and reaching for you, almost like an embrace.
Yeah.
An idea of if it touched you, you know, it's cold, clammy hands, you know, of a drowned person. Oh, all of that stuff. And then there's the whole idea of the doppelganger, you know, that sense of somebody out there who's following you. It reminded me of... It follows that sort of slow, steady, but really bloody scary idea. Oh.
And just, a harbinger of your own death. Like, none of us, I don't think anyone really wants to know how and when you're going to die. Or, you know, because obviously, despite the bloated, disfigured nature of this corpse, it's clearly young Alice's young dead body. So that's telling her would appear to be giving her a very clear message that you're going to die soon. I'm not sure I would fancy knowing that, to be honest. That wouldn't be information I would like anyone to pass on. Just the doppelganger in mythology, as you say, is maybe not originally when it was originally conceived, but it's come to be known as, like, if you see your doppelganger, that's bad news. And you're probably going to, you know, it might even show you the circumstances of your death. Although there's then the counter to that is, like, is it giving you a warning? Is it trying to say, oh, you know, don't go swimming in the near future. Yeah. Maybe that was what it was trying to achieve, and she sort of cocked up and didn't follow the warning. You know, who knows?
And also that idea of is this a ghost? As in, is it literally made out of, you know, very, very thin matter and will disappear the minute that she properly lays eyes on it? Because it isn't presented like that. I believe that, you know, it is the actress who plays Alice dressed up walking towards her. And I think towards the end, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's just something I read, and I couldn't remember this bit, but the show went before the end credits roll. I think they show like a very brief shot, which is from the opposite perspective, showing quote unquote alive Alice walking with the sun sort of behind her. Yeah, it's a very short shot, and I wonder if it's like if there is an afterlife, and the idea that you maybe are a ghost and you can warn people. Imagine trying to warn people, all you're doing is scaring them. That idea of, you know, the ghost maybe wants to warn her but doesn't know any other way to do so.
Yeah, and it's we're back to the sad thing again, but a lot of ghost stories do have that as the end. Oh, the scary ghost was actually not trying to be malicious. Yeah. It was just trying to tell us something. And it's a bit of the tragedy of, oh, bloody hell, all I'm trying to do is tell you to, like, you know, put your bins out, but because I'm forced to be presented in this creepy way, you're all running off every time I appear in the living room. You
know? The thing that I will say about this, and I hope you don't mind me getting too deep on this real quick.
Not at all. Not in the slightest.
Yeah, I don't think that they'll mind me telling this story. So, I've never had a paranormal experience that I can lay my hand on.
I don't believe.
But I did have a strange experience once, which I'll very quickly tell you because it has shades of this.
Please do.
Now, it's very sad, some of this. So, long story short, one of my best friends lost his dad to... he took his own life. Oh. We were all about 17 years old or so. And it was very, very traumatic and very tragic, as you can imagine, especially for my friend, because he actually was the one who discovered the body, which is obviously... something that you wouldn't wish on anybody. No. Now, this is relevant in a way because it links in a way with what we were talking about at the beginning about, you know, the closure and lack of closure. Now, a few years down the line, no, God, not even that, maybe about a year down the line after this person's passed, it's Christmas Eve and I'm stood outside a pub with a few others, it's sort of a smoking area, you know, just say no, kids. And, you know, it's obviously very dark and very cold outside. Now, this is in a little village in Hampshire. I won't name it, but you've got this big, long main road that comes down and it cuts through a square. And it cuts through the square, you then walk off the other side. And the pub is right on the edge of the square. So from where you are, you're in prime position to see anyone coming or going from a long way off. So anyway, I'm stood there having a drink with my friend who I mentioned, and he goes back inside. And I'm still out there with his older sister, who, and I'll tell you what happened later on because it is relevant. I'm still out there with his older sister having a conversation, and we end up talking a bit about the dad and everything else. And it's a bit sad, but you know we had a couple of drinks and it's all of this. And I then see her like sort of looking over my shoulder a bit as I'm talking to her, and I went, everything all right? And I turn around and we both see this bloke walking down this road, and it's very, very dark, as I said, and you can see, like, you know, there's orangey sort of street lights, and he walks under one of them, and as he walks under the first one, I go, this is kind of strange. He walks under the sort of second one, and I look again, and the closest he gets to us is probably about 30-40 yards away, and he looks right at us and then sort of just carries on walking. The guy was the spitting image of my friend's dad. A very distinct looking man, you know, had quite a distinct nose and chin, and very distinct curly hair too. Now, this guy could just happen to have been a bit of a lookalike and just happened to be walking past at that moment. But it's one of those things that...
These experiences are very personal, aren't they? Because of course, as a person who doesn't believe in the paranormal, which I am, you know, even though I'm very interested in it and enjoy fictional articulations of it, I am not a believer. No. So it's very easy for me to say, well, by the process of elimination, given my beliefs, I therefore that must have just been a lookalike and it was just a bit of a coincidence.
I mean, what I believe happened.
But I can never prove that because I wasn't there, and that's what makes these things so kind of personal and meaningful to people.
Yeah, there is an unfortunate, sad twist to this story, and that is that the sister, who was, like I said, quite a bit older than my friend, she, after this, because she was very shaken by it all, about 6 months later, she actually drank herself to death.
Oh, bloody hell, that's really sad. That's
so terrible. So this, it's one of those stories, I actually didn't tell him anything about it for years, you know, this guy is my best friend. And eventually one day I did tell him, and I said the reason it feels weird is because the one other person that witnessed this with me has now died. And Yeah, God. But you are right.
And I suppose if that experience did play a part in what happened to her subsequently, you kind of feel you have to tell him. But what a sad thing.
It's very sad. And again, you know, the reason why this sort of final act, if you like, of the film, I think works so well is it doesn't take a genius to figure out that Alice is probably having suicidal thoughts and suicide ideation. And so even if it is an extended metaphor of her seeing her own death coming for her, you know, it's there. But it's the method of it too. It's the idea that they are in a dry lake in the middle of nowhere and a waterlogged body is then walking towards her. The juxtaposition is huge.
Yeah.
And really... I mean, I know that it's sad too, but it's very, very scary.
Yeah, yeah.
there's no
powerful image, proper scary, and that's it. The film operates in both those ways.
Yeah.
It's got the sadness and the grief and the kind of understated sort of melancholy, and then it's got it's proper scary. That's a chilling image to kind of leave in your mind, etched into your mind. It's doing a lot of work on a number of levels. There was one, you know. The film concludes, as you say, in a kind of ambiguous way where that's your lot really in terms of the story. You're not getting any more closure or clarity. There is that brilliant during the credits. I don't think it's post credits. I think it's during where it goes back and shows you a load of clips again that you've had sprinkled, you know, family home movies, even the photograph of the family outside their house. And you realize because it zooms in on it for you that Alice was there all along. She's in the background, she's in the window staring out at them,
even in the picture body. That we know has been doctored by the brother. Enough, we see that picture initially and you see her there, and it's pretty obvious that it's a doctored picture,
cut and paste.
but then it zooms in the other direction. You go, wait, what? And then you see Alice there, and she looks so much more integrated because she is actually there. And you think, oh, bloody hell.
She was there in that photo, just in the corner, standing behind a bush kind of thing. But And I would say, with spoilers, I guess, we touched on Ghostwatch. Definitely an inspiration, because Ghostwatch did a lot of that. It was like, you know, creepy old Mr. Pipes hidden in the background of a number of shots. I think that movie or that TV show, one-off BBC, you know, hoax documentary, certainly inspired elements of this film. But I love what they've done with it, you know.
Yeah, and to be honest as well, the fact that the actual conflict in the show is almost resolved once her diary and her phone have been discovered, it does have that classic element of the ghost has unfinished business. But equally, you see that it's actually, I found it really emotional thinking about the final bit where you have that parallel footage of the mum and Alice in their respective sort of hypnotherapy sessions, where they're talking about, and you see these long panning shots of the house, you know, on the inside, very, very well done. And if we got a second, I'd just like to say one of the things that I think makes this movie really stand out is they do these lovely, gorgeously shot set pieces, sometimes of like the clouds or the stars and the weather. And there's that one where they come back from the funeral, but for some reason their car's buggered, so they have to reverse, and it's quite a very uncanny moment. And then of course in this you see the house as it pans around, and it's this idea that Alice can see her mum in this, but the mum can't see her,
Alice is talking to they're both talking to the same
therapist.
There's the bloke Ray, who, you know, turns out no real sinister motivations, he was just a kind of red herring. And Alice, I think, is recounting to him a dream that she's had where she sees her mum in bed. And the mum is recounting to him a dream she's had where Alice has approached her while she's asleep. And as you say, they're both they're experiencing the same incident from two separate perspectives, one after death and after, you know, one before her death and one after her death, which is a brilliant, brilliant idea.
It's a great idea, and one that I think, you know, has been used before, but it feels fresh in this, I think, because it's made us wait for it. It's made us wait for this stuff. And actually, to leave it on that note of, I guess you could call it reconciliation as opposed to proper solution.
Yes.
You know, we are left with some questions as to what happens next, you know, but then of course the pictures I think show us that, you know, if they had actually only looked a bit closer, maybe this is a metaphor for how they raised Alice. If they'd only looked a bit closer, they'd have seen her all along.
Yeah. You know? And the family, in a way, you know, in a weird way, a happy ending, closure is achieved because they decide to move. So there's this element
they
stop having any of these paranormal experiences and they decide to move to a new house and move on with their lives. And it's just a happier, the obvious thing would have been horrible ending, they've split up, and they don't go down that route, which I think is a good choice.
No, it's funny because despite the bleak subject matter, it's not a bleak film. It deliberately, you know, I would say that one of the things that makes this film work is the warmth of the individuals in it, but obviously that then makes the death and the grief feel all the more real, because it's hard, you know, some of the films that are like needlessly bleak, it just makes you go, why would I care about any of these people?
Why am I watching this and just depressed? Yeah. And I agree, it maybe, I don't know whether we've succeeded in conveying this or not, but it is not a depressing, miserable film. It's actually a compelling mystery that rattles along at quite a good pace. And yes, it is sad, but it's successfully sad, not you just wallowing in some, you know...
Yeah.
You feel like you've misspent your 90 minutes. It doesn't feel like that at all.
No. I wonder if people will feel that they've misspent their 90 minutes listening to us. Who knows?
We will see. We will find out. What we haven't got is, that's because they haven't got to the twist yet. We need a big twist to let's have a think. What could it be? I was going to mention, we touched on this sort of found footage. So obviously there's loads and loads of found footage horror films. People, you know, the list goes on indefinitely, starting with Blair Witch and billions of others. And we did an episode about the Blair Witch Project where we touched on some of these. We also did an episode on a 2014 film called Creep, which was a clever little found
great
footage.
Great film. Very good.
So I suppose I wanted to touch here instead on specifically fake documentary type found footage type films. So yeah, Ghost Watch, massive plug for that because it's ace. Even films like District 9, remember that one? The sci-fi District 9 thing, kind of actually, a fake documentary.
On the on the subject of aliens or like extraterrestrial horror, if you like, a very underrated film I watched called The Fourth Kind, which is it's a weird one. It really got panned in some quarters, but I thought it had some moments where it was genuinely quite scary. It was a documentary about the idea of, I think they're in Nome, Alaska.
Okay.
So obviously a very long way away from anything.
Yeah.
And these are abductions and sort of things that have been happening with aliens. And it's shot in split documentary, which is really odd and takes some getting used to. But like they have actors playing the parts and they have the original interview, which is grainy and all this sort of stuff. So it's clever.
Yeah.
It's got a few moments that you go, what is happening here? But, you know, and I found that really good. Another fake documentary that I really think just doesn't get enough love, really. I think that Rec technically is a fake documentary.
Yeah, it's very true. You know? My favourite zombie film, Rec.
It gets a lot of love for the zombie stuff.
Yeah.
But I think people forget that the setup is really, really well done. It makes total sense. You know, we're
makes
a news
it
channel.
Seem believable. It's a news broadcast. I've got Rec down on my list. So brilliant that you've covered that, because that film is. Yeah, I'll definitely have to do an episode on that at some point, because it's a.
Oh, you haven't done it already? Nope. Oh, well,
never done Rec.
That is remiss.
You're spot on. Yeah, absolutely.
Bloody great film that.
It's really good. And then I'll just mention one other because of course you can just Google fake documentaries, only because I watched it sort of very recently before recording, because it got, you know, very subjective, some of these, because a lot of them are kind of micro budget, young people, up and coming filmmakers, and that can be a bit hit and miss, even if, you know, sometimes the acting can be a bit crap. And I think this film sadly fell a bit foul of that. It was a film called The Last Broadcast, which came out in the 90s, pre Blair Witch. So the speculation is that it probably was quite influential on Blair Witch. It is set in the woods. It's about people investigating the Jersey Devil. And it's got some good ideas. But just unlike Lake Mungo's big, amazing end twist, this one does have an end twist, which I did not find amazing. I thought it was really disappointing load of bollocks. Yeah. So, but that's really subjective, isn't it? So perhaps other people will enjoy that movie if you want to check it out. But there are quite a lot. There's a load I've never seen yet. So this is kind of pointing me towards a new little subgenre that I might investigate further. The fake documentary film.
Isn't this always the thing that gets bandied around about found footage generally, is that it's very easy to make.
Yeah.
But like anything, it's very hard to make something that's good.
Yeah.
And sometimes what makes something good might transcend a budget, but quite often you need to have half decent actors, you need to have some decent production values to make it feel appropriately fake.
You definitely need to be good at editing.
Yeah.
The editing's the key.
Yeah. But I tell you what though, one extra tiny little thing, which I'll say, it's not so much a documentary, it's more of like a straight up found footage. This person has been filming. I mean, they're a really obsessive individual who's filming everything around him for that reason. But it's called Leaving DC, and it's on Amazon Prime. It's really odd. I won't say too much. It's very restrained. Way more than I thought it would be. And I watched it thinking, God, this is going to be a bit silly, isn't it? You know, like I don't. It's literally one person. But it's this guy who's left Washington DC to get away from it all, and he's living in somewhere, and he's trying his best to keep a level head. He's part of a I believe he's supposed to be like on the spectrum. He's very sort of intense, and he's part of the support group back in the city. So he keeps filming these like vlog updates for them all the time, and weird things start to happen outside his house late at night. He starts recording the noise, like he gets a little Tascam recorder and starts recording, and he hears these really strange noises, which you have to listen to yourself. I don't want to ruin it, but it ends in a really silly, downbeat fashion, but it again...
It's got some good stuff. Well, your last recommendation, last time you left me with a tantalising recommendation at the end of a recording, it was Late Bundo, so you have a good, solid track record. But,
so did we make it into the Hall of Pine, Mike?
I actually do have a twist just prior to that reveal, to that big reveal. I've just remembered something. Is the bloke who made this film, Joel Anderson, has kind of disappeared, which is weird, isn't it? Now, I don't think it's not like he's a missing person. That's not true. I would, you know, in some ways, this is a sensationalist part of me would love it if it was. But he's definitely stopped making stuff and sort of dropped off the public. You know, no one really knows why or what's happened to his film. You watch Lake Mungo, you think, wow, this guy must have gone on to have a great filmmaking career. Nope, he did absolutely fuck all. So that's a little bit of an odd mystery in itself.
It does make you wonder, really. You know, he's in the wind, and we don't really know why. Like you say, we don't know. And one of the most googled things is, you know, when you search him up, is where is he?
Yeah, what's happened to what has happened to Joel Anderson? So, if Joel Anderson, if you're listening, then hope you're all right, and please make another film. Probably not a sequel, because I don't think this is one of those films that merits a direct follow-on.
I think we should get him over here and we should do a version of Lake Mungo, but set on Wigan Pier. That would be interesting.
A podcast version, an even more micro-budget version. Just some blokes drinking cans and eating pies, sat dangling their legs in the River Douglas or the canal or whatever. I can't remember where the pier is. I should know that.
Brilliant.
So yeah, back to your previous question of does Lake Mungo make it into the Hall of Pain? Of course, this is always a tense moment for every guest as they wait to find out whether they've done a convincing enough job. The tension's somewhat alleviated by the fact that nothing has ever failed ever. But, you know, there's bound to be a day, but I'm pleased to tell you that today is not that day. So your recommendation of Lake Mungo is, of course, very, very warmly or coldly welcomed into the Hall of Pain, where it will be given its own cell in which we will put that 40-quid DVD, I suppose, can go and live it there.
And Bob Smeet and his mates can enjoy the barbecue down there.
They can visit and they can do the various with their hats with corks dangling off them and all the other stereotypes that we know and love that only probably exist in the UK. But hey ho.
Indeed.
I blame Neighbours. I blame Neighbours and Home and Away.
I blame them for everything, really.
And they probably blame us. But good filmmakers, clearly, as we have learned.
Well, certainly one of them is, but maybe they don't appreciate good filmmakers because he's disappeared and he's wandering around Lake Mungo hoping that someone's going to notice him at this point.
Oh.
Maybe he's the remains they found. They buried him out there.
It's another time slip plotting masterpiece. On which sinister note, we will leave you, listeners, in peace and dread and horror, and speak to you again very soon. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Well, that concludes another episode of Dark Natter, and a huge, enormous thank you to Mr. James for being a fantastic guest, and also for a really moving story during that episode, as well as some excellent analysis, and a great movie recommendation, which I would wholeheartedly suggest you go and check out. I think that sort of Blu-ray version is now available in the UK, so it's a bit easier to get your hands on as well. And of course, don't forget to check out Mr. James's podcast, which is Right in the Schoolies, where various guests, including me, a few months ago, recount our memories of school. If you were also looking to check something out, then as usual, don't forget to have a look at my website, which is www.john-richter.com. John spelt J-O-N, Richter spelt R-I-C-H-T-E-R. Or just Google John Richter and you can find all my books. My most recent one was The Warden, psychological techno-thriller, out a few weeks ago. I would be delighted if you would grab yourself a copy. Otherwise, do tune in soon. We will be back with more dark, sinister natterings, murmurings of mayhem, mumblings of misfortune. And until then, look after yourselves and don't have too many nightmares. Or if you do, make sure they're good ones.